From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, giving it one more try, we'll dig into the latest effort to bring regional transportation to Wayne, Oakland, Macomb, and Washtenaw counties. What's different from previous failed plans? Plus, helping communities decide whether to say yes to wind turbines.
It's really important that you go into any big decision like this with your eyes wide open about either what negatives this could bring or what positives you could be leaving on the table by saying no.
Concerns over facial recognition technology being used by Detroit police.
It's very good at identifying white male faces. It's not as good as identifying women, and it's especially not very good at identifying people of color.
And we'll tell you why researchers are on the hunt in Michigan for minerals on Uncle Sam's wish list. Those stories and more today for you on Stateside. Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Coming up on today's show, Michigan's mineral resources. The Department of Interior wants to reduce our dependence on foreign sources for precious metals. And we'll talk to a couple of researchers charged with finding out just what lies beneath our feet. That's later in the hour. But first, for years, the Regional Transit Authority, the RTA, has been trying and failing to launch a plan to bring a coordinated mass transit system to Wayne, Oakland, Macomb, and Washtenaw counties. The plans include a web of highways, bus rapid transit, and train lines, with Detroit serving as a sort of a hub. After suffering a defeat at the ballot box in 2016 and another rejection by its board in 2018, the RTA is back again with another plan. Megan Owens of Transportation Riders United is here with us. Megan, remind us why the previous plans just didn't generate enough support.
Well, it's important to remember that the vast majority of people in this region do drive and don't necessarily have a lot of experience with public transit until suddenly their car breaks down and they have to get to a job. Their kid is suddenly asking them to drive them everywhere they need to go. Their grandparent needs to get to appointments. This region doesn't have as much experience with public transit, but once people do have a personal experience, do see why it's necessary that that support really grows. So this is a relatively new issue for our region to take on. Yes, we've been working on it for a couple of years, but the recognition of how important it is only continues to grow the more we do have a chance to talk with people about it.
So tell us about this plan, particularly what's new or different.
Well, a lot of it does build on the strengths of the previous plans. There are some pieces that are very popular, a commuter train between Detroit and Ann Arbor, airport express service, so you can drive a couple miles, park your car and get a convenient, affordable ride directly to the airport. It would increase the frequency of transit along some of the busiest corridors and then connect to some of the places that you completely can't get to right now, that if you don't drive, you are completely without access. But they did really try to listen to the concerns that have been brought up by some parts of the community. The northern most parts of Oakland and Macomb County, while they would like to see some transit improvement, they don't see nearly the value that the rest of the region would. So if the legislature allows it, this plan would actually include just the southern two-thirds of Oakland and Macomb County, along with Wayne and Washtenaw counties. And this plan also includes more pilots for things like incorporating new mobility, all of these great new technologies that are coming in. We know they're going to change how we get around. Let's make sure that the public sector has an active role in making sure these new services work for everyone, not just the wealthiest, not just the people right in the heart of downtown. So I feel like this plan did a nice job of continuing with some of the core pieces people really want to see, like getting around more frequently, more reliably. But it takes into account some of the complaints people had in the past.
Yeah.
It
keeps the commuter rail service between Ann Arbor and Detroit, because I know a lot of people wanted that. And then the airport express line would still be in there as well.
Yes, those are definitely some of the most popular components. And people just say, why on earth do we not already have these types of options. Well, we just haven't been willing to fund them yet. Well, hopefully that's about to change.
Megan, with Brooks Patterson set to retire next year, do you have new confidence that the next head of Oakland County will support a regional transit authority plan to kind of wed this region together with transit?
There's definitely no guarantees. Certainly, several of the leading contenders are very strong transit supporters and do want to see Oakland County really as a leader in public transit, as opposed to being seen as the barrier that, unfortunately, Brooks Patterson has proven to be. But regardless of who the leader is, we're going to continue to demonstrate how the people all across Oakland County really would benefit from having these types of options, even if you never get on it. More reliable workers, less traffic on the highway. There's real benefits for everyone.
And that's what
we hope to make sure.
And what about Macomb exec Mark Hackle, who has been against RTE plans so far? Any sense where he might stand on plans going forward?
Well, the conversations are still ongoing. He's certainly been willing to talk. Removing the most rural northern counties addresses some of the big concerns. So you have places way up like Romeo or Armada that would not be asked to pay twice. And it also really does address some of the concerns. From past plans, like why does Gratiot get so much focus when they've got more businesses along Mound and Van Dyke? Well, this really gives more priority to Mound and Van Dyke. So hopefully by the RTA really listened to what those complaints are, really addressed the vast majority of them. And this is not the final plan. The RTA is going to be spending the next 3 months asking, is this right? We've listened, we've adjusted. Is this, in fact, what our communities need? So starting this Thursday in Ann Arbor, in August, they'll have a meeting in Macomb County, in September in Oakland County. They're really going around to each county to ask, here's what we think we heard from you.
Listening to the people.
Did we get it right?
Megan Owens, Transportation Riders United. As always, Megan, thanks so much.
You're very welcome.
Across the world, there has been dramatic airplane pilot shortage. North America will need over 200,000 new pilots in the next 2 decades. That's according to Boeing. But as the demand for pilots keeps growing, the number of women in the industry has not, except locally, as Interlaken Public Radio's Bronte Cook reports.
Give it a second.
Jesse Martin starts the engine on a single-propeller plane at Northwestern Michigan College. The skies are clear and the plane is ready for takeoff. But right now, it's a little too windy to fly.
This is our attitude indicator. This is our heading indicator. This gives us.
Martin is an aviation student and flight instructor at NMC. If the weather cooperates, she'll be lifting off for a night fly across the city in just a few hours.
The runways and the cities and everything are so beautiful when they're all lit up at night.
Martin grew up in Leelanau County. When she was 14, she shadowed a local pilot and flew in a plane for the very first time.
And he's like, who's never flown? And I'm like, I've never been in a plane. He put me up in the front with him, and I fell in love.
But she ended up becoming a zookeeper instead. It wasn't until she was in her 40s and had moved back to the area that she turned to aviation. 50 years ago in the U.S., women made up 1% of commercial pilots. Today, it's 6%.
Women overall, we're definitely an untapped resource. Yeah, the field is opening up, but when we're out there flying, even in the office, it's mostly guys.
But even with the guys, numbers are shrinking. Faye Malarkey Black is the president of the Regional Airline Association. She says pilot shortages are happening because lots of pilots are retiring, and it's getting harder to get a license. Plus, more passengers are traveling around the world, increasing the demand for aviators.
We are obviously facing a really big problem.
Malarkey Black says many airlines and flight schools have added financial and lifestyle benefits to attract pilots, and they've started recruiting more aggressively.
regionals and main lines all have targeted recruiting that aim to make the flight deck look a lot more like the cabins and the customers that we serve.
Which includes more women pilots. The aviation program at NMC is not doing that. They're not specifically recruiting women pilots. But somehow, the number of women in their program is double the national average. Alex Bloy is the director of the program.
Yeah, the more women that we ended up enrolling, the more inspiration we had for the next generation. People want to see themselves in that population. They want to be inspired.
Looking at the program, it's like, okay, it's not all guys, so that made it more comfortable for me personally.
That's NMC aviation student Jessie Martin again.
It's nice to have other women that we can, you know, talk to and relate to and say, how did you overcome this challenge?
Opportunities for female pilots to connect are growing. There are nonprofits that provide scholarships and host conferences and closed Facebook groups where they can talk privately about things, like how to dress for the job when most pilot outfits are tailored for men, or childcare options while pursuing a travel-oriented career. And sometimes female pilots bond through long-lasting traditions.
Blaine County Traffic Classic Racer 30, turning left onto Taxiway Charlie.
That's the sound of a radio call from Martin's plane during the Air Race Classic last month. A race just for women. Martin competed in the race with fellow NMC aviation student Hannah Beard. They flew 2,600 miles in the single propeller plane.
Classic Racer 30, clear of the runways on Taxiway Charlie.
Women's air racing began 90 years ago when 20 female pilots, including Amelia Earhart, flew cross country.
It's really great to be doing something that so many other women have done before us.
This year, over 100 female pilots competed in the race. Martin's team was the first from NMC, and they came in 15th place. I'm Bronte Cook.
After the break, the ongoing debate over facial recognition and high-def surveillance camera use in Detroit. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The Detroit Police Department is looking to tap into the city's growing network of high-definition surveillance cameras, even as critics of video surveillance and facial recognition technology worry about abuse and violating the Fourth Amendment. Michigan Radio Sarah Swick is with us. The DPD is looking for $4 million from City Council. Why is this? What do police want to do?
Well, the Detroit police have what they call a real-time crime center currently in their downtown Detroit police headquarters. And what that is it's a facility that gets streaming video footage from all over the city from what are called Project Greenlight locations. And those are cameras that are installed in various locations throughout the city, mostly gas stations, restaurants, some churches, and things like that. But right now, they have well over 500 locations, so all of that video footage is pouring into the real-time crime center in presumably in real time. So the police say they've basically outgrown that current facility and they want to expand it. And they also want to add two sort of new mini centers at two precincts on the city's east and west sides and what the police chief calls, you know, a couple of the higher crime areas.
Now, we've been following this debate over the DPD using facial recognition software for a year or so without any standard operating guidelines, but now they're looking to expand this.
Yes, they are, although it's important to sort of understand the nuances here. Chief James Craig, whenever this subject is brought up, is very insistent on the fact that the facial recognition technology or the use of that software is a standalone technology and it's separate from the streaming video that's actually coming in all the time to police headquarters. So, yes, the department has been using this technology for a year or more without a formal policy in place, and that's been a subject of some serious controversy lately with the Board of Police Commissioners trying to get one approved, but it hasn't actually been formally approved yet. But yes, they're looking to get more cameras out on the streets. They're going to be mounting, the city's going to be mounting traffic light cameras on some 400 traffic lights on thoroughfares throughout the city. So that's going to add to that entire surveillance network. And while the facial recognition technology piece of it is technically separate, it is a part of the whole kit and caboodle here.
I know from your reporting that Chief Craig has made it very clear that facial recognition and these high-definition surveillance cameras have helped solve crimes.
Yeah, he's been very clear about that and says it's now, you know, standard protocol when there's, for example, a shooting for police to go and say, okay, what's the location of the shooting? And then say, what's the possible getaway route for a suspect? And then to go along sort of that route and pull any camera footage from the green light locations and try to locate a suspect or a getaway vehicle or something that can help identify a perpetrator. The police did tell the city council yesterday that both green light footage and the facial recognition technology helped them solve or at least get a suspect for a rather horrific crime that occurred back in May, where five LGBTQ people on the east side of Detroit were shot and three were killed. And Chief Craig says that without that green light footage and without the facial recognition technology, they would never have apprehended that suspect. So it seems pretty clear that it is helping police solve crimes to at least to some extent. On the other hand, the evidence when it comes to does it actually prevent crime seems a lot more murky.
Let's talk about what opponents are worried about. What are their concerns?
Well, there's basically two main points of concern here. The first is that it's pretty well established that the algorithms that are used to sort of process faces through this facial recognition technology software is very good at identifying white male faces. It's not as good as identifying women, and it's especially not very good at identifying people of color and especially women of color. So there's that concern about sort of bias and mistaken identity. But there's also sort of a larger just civil liberties concern here about how much surveillance are we going to tolerate in the name of crime prevention or solving crime? And can police just track you around town? If you're a protester in a protest, can facial recognition technology be used to identify you? You know, Detroit police tend to sort of say, you know, we're only going to use this in very specific circumstances, but, you know, those are only sort of policy guidelines. And there's, you know, I think the concern is about that we're opening up a whole series of larger questions here and a big can of worms in going forward with this technology.
Have you heard from any citizens who say, I don't care, I'd rather be safe?
Yeah, I've heard from a couple of people who have said that and said, you know, people who were themselves victims of crimes who said, you know, if this helps the police actually solve crimes, I am all for it. And I think that it's a good thing that will make the city safer. Now, notably, I've also heard from a couple of people who, including one father whose daughter was recently murdered, who said, I don't really think that this is a tool that I want in this city, and that I think the answer is more, you know, police on the street rather than these surveillance cameras. So I think it's pretty fair to say that public opinion is fairly divided.
And it is worth noting that state representatives have introduced a bill to kind of hit the hold button and slow down this rush to facial recognition technology. Meantime, when will city council decide whether the police can have that extra $4 million?
I believe that is on the agenda for next Tuesday's meeting.
Michigan Radio's Sarah Swick. Sarah, thanks so much.
Thank you, Cindy.
The federal government is on the hunt for minerals. The Interior Department has drawn up a list of 35 minerals it considers critical to our economy and our national security. And now it's handing out grants to researchers to help these researchers find out how many of these essential minerals they can find. The goal is to stop buying minerals from foreign countries and step up mining here at home. We turn now to Western Michigan University and say hello to Bill Harrison, Professor Emeritus, who's with the Michigan Geological Survey, where he directs the Michigan Basin Core Research Laboratory, and Peter Voice, who is a research scientist whose focus is on the history of mining in Michigan. Welcome to the program.
Thanks. We're happy to be here.
Yes, we're happy to be here.
So WMU gets a grant to help figure out if minerals that are deemed important to U.S. national security could be found in Michigan, so the nation doesn't have to rely on foreign sources. Bill, did I get that pretty right?
Yes. In fact, this is a response to congressional report that was published in 2017 by the United States Senate that identified the fact that we are becoming increasingly dependent on foreign sources for a number of important critical minerals that we use in our everyday lives. The minerals that go into producing cell phones, television sets, it's very important in satellite technology. The computers we're using today for this broadcast are related to all those minerals that go into the equipment and machines that we have. So we're really starting to get concerned about that foreign dependency.
Well, we can't list all of the 35 minerals in the government's final list of 35 minerals deemed critical to U.S. national security and the economy. But, Bill, can you give us a few of the most prominent ones, some of the most ones that are pertinent possibly to Michigan?
Well, people have heard of these. A couple of examples, lithium. Lithium, you hear about lithium batteries all the time. Lithium's used in lots of different materials, but one of the key things, because it's such a good conductor and it stores electrons, is in new technology batteries. Cobalt is another one. And actually, in most batteries, you have an anode and a cathode, which directs the positive and negative currents. And the lithium is at one part and the cobalt is in a different part. So you need both of those elements to be able to construct a lithium battery.
Peter, there is a long, long history here in Michigan of doing these kinds of surveys. Tell us more about them. How do you go about this? And again, building on this long history.
Well, today we gather production statistics from mines through surveys. They send out a questionnaire to the company, and the company will fill out how much they're producing, what they're producing, send it back to the U.S. Geological Survey, and then that data gets compiled and produced as what are referred to as mineral yearbook reports. And so I've been compiling the statistics from those books for the last couple years. Michigan's mining history started in the 1840s, has gone to the present. And in 2013 dollars, the total sum of that production has been about $500 billion.
You know, I suspect because it's kind of out of sight, out of mind, that the average person isn't aware that that $500 billion is a sizable chunk of money. I think most people aren't aware there's such a thriving mining industry in Michigan still.
Oh, yes. We are still actively producing rock salt, gypsum, iron ore. Copper. We've produced 1.5 billion metric tons of iron ore from this state.
Hmm. When you think of this list of 35 minerals that the government is particularly interested in, do we have any sense from these, for example, these yearbooks that you've mentioned, Peter, that and its history, whether Michigan does indeed have some of these minerals?
It does. We have actually produced some of these minerals in the past. Potash, which is a source of potassium, was mined here in Michigan for a number of years in the 80s and 90s. It's currently not being mined, but it could be again. We produced manganese from the iron ores. We weren't a huge producer of manganese, but it's an important commodity.
And where in Michigan might these minerals be located?
Well, the main target is the western Upper Peninsula. That's where we have crystalline bedrock present near the surface that hosts a lot of these iron ore and copper ore deposits, and the associated critical minerals would be hosted in those rocks as well. The potash was primarily from the central part of the Lower Peninsula.
Bill Harrison, I've got to ask you, because people are going to have in their minds some environmental concerns. With this survey, could we ultimately start having multinational mining companies, you know, coming into Michigan communities, taking what is good and profitable out of the ground, and then kind of leaving the cleanup to the local people and to the state?
Well, Michigan is actually one of the national leaders in environmental management. The DEQ has significant body of regulations that manage all of the energy and natural resources that are produced in the state of Michigan. And as Peter mentioned, we've been doing this for a long time here in the state. There is a wide variety of different types of materials that get produced in addition to the materials that Peter mentioned. There's a new mine up near Marquette that produces copper, produces platinum, and some of the platinum-related elements. Those are also critical elements. And that plant, although it took many years to get it licensed and certified, the work between the state of Michigan and the U.S. EPA have really created a historically sophisticated mining operation. And it will mine for perhaps a decade or so. It started a few years ago. And when it's all done, you won't even be able to tell it was there. It's amazing how the new technologies in mining have really created an opportunity to have a pretty clean environment once that mining operation is completed. And the companies are bonded to make sure that they're able to clean up any contamination issues that might occur.
Besides jobs, clearly that would be right there up front. In what other ways would Michigan and people in Michigan benefit if we got more mining here? How would we benefit?
Well, there's actually spinoff effect, of course. Anytime you have an industry that develops newly in a community, there's a lot of supporting industries, energy industry, mechanics, any kind of support facilities. But in addition to that, a lot of these minerals are extracted from state land, under state forests, or sometimes in the case of federal land, national forests. And there's actually a royalty that gets paid to the state as a result of that mining. So there is an income. There's also, of course, fees and taxes that come into the treasury. But some portion of the profits from those minerals will actually get plowed back into the state. The example I mentioned of this mine near Marquette, there's actually a lot of the proceeds that are coming to the state from that mine are going back into the local community, into local schools, local parks. And so these industries not only generate the natural resources that are important for our society, but they do bring financial benefits to the local regions and also to the state in general.
Peter Voice, since you are, you know, focused on the history of mining in Michigan, I'm sure it wouldn't surprise you to know that for some people, they heard Bill say state forest land, federal forest land, and went, protect that. But and Bill was alluding to the fact that things are done differently now than in the past. Have we learned from the lessons of the past?
Oh, yes. We know a lot more about how to clean up groundwater, how to make sure that we protect the tailings so that they're not being leached and putting harmful contaminants into the water supply. It's a much different world than it was 150 years ago.
How could this survey transform Michigan, Bill Harrison?
Well, we understand a lot about the geology. That's really our job as a geological survey. Our mandate when the Geological Survey was first created, it was actually the first state agency that got created when Michigan became a state, because the early legislature realized that natural resources can provide enormous potential for growth and development in a particular state. So we continue that today, and all of the different activities related to the natural resources in the state are part of the responsibility of the Geological Survey. We're here at Western Michigan University because we are the group of scientists that have spent the most time and have the most experience looking at Michigan geology. We look at things like the energy systems. We work with oil and gas industry to help them better understand where the potential opportunities are. We work with the Underground Natural Gas Storage Group. Michigan is the state that leads the nation in underground natural gas storage, so that we have a continuous and important supply of natural gas resources. We work with the DEQ and with private industry in terms of the mining activities, and we work with the environmental groups and with the water resource groups to better understand the water resources. Where are our water resources, and how can we best protect those? So the scientific application of the knowledge that we gather about the underground environment in Michigan is beneficial for many activities, but primarily focused around our natural resources.
And ultimately, as you conduct these surveys to see just where Michigan might be able to supply some of these 35 critical minerals. It's clear the Interior Department says this is not a final list. This is going to be ongoing. So this idea of let's focus back on where the domestic sources of these minerals would be could in the long run pay off for Michigan.
Absolutely. The reason these were identified as critical minerals is that the vast majority of them were either 100% or some high proportion dependent on foreign sources. There are many other minerals. There's several hundred that are reported on each year by the U.S. Geological Survey that Peter mentioned that tracks all the production data. But these 35 are the ones that are the most concerned when it comes to geopolitical issues. These minerals are really strategic from the standpoint of maintaining U.S. industry and certainly our defense as well.
Work being done by Western Michigan University, where the Michigan Geological Survey boasts Professor Emeritus Bill Harrison and also research scientist Peter Voice. Thanks to both of you for sharing the work that you're doing with us on Stateside.
Thank you very much.
Yes, thank you.
Coming up, leaders in rural Michigan communities could well be deciding whether to allow wind turbine development. We're going to talk about the pros and the cons of wind farms after the break. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. What can we do about global climate change? Harnessing the wind to create green energy is one answer. The Michigan Public Service Commission tells us wind generation is the primary source of alternative energy in this state. But that means wind turbines, a lot of them. As of last month, Michigan has a total of 1,051 operational turbines, and there are more on the way. And while some communities welcome wind farms and the lease dollars they generate along with power, others push back to keep them out of their backyards. Sarah Bannis-Mills has worked with and studied many Michigan communities while they decide yes or no on wind farms. She's with Close Up, the Center for Local, State, and Urban Policy at the Gerald R. Ford School of Public Policy at the University of Michigan. Great to have you here, because this is something that it's not going away. Wind farms are here. You can't miss them as you drive around into the Thumb or even in Canada as you go along 401 outside of Windsor. You cannot miss them. And I know you've gone around the state. You've given presentations to 25 Michigan communities who are considering turbine development. What's your message when you talk with these people?
My message is that they need to think carefully about the pros and cons of wind development before they make their rules. So they need to know what they're getting themselves into or what opportunities they're saying no to if they decide not to have wind in their community.
Now, Michigan's first wind farm came online in 2001. Now we have more than 28, most of them in the Thumb. Briefly, help us understand, how do these wind farms operate? Like, who owns them and what kind of lease payments and tax dollars can they mean for landowners and communities?
Sure. So usually the wind developer does not own the land that the wind turbine sits on. They own the turbine itself, but not that land. They lease it, have a long-term lease with the landowner, and that landowner gets paid. It varies, but they get paid for effectively the land that's taken out of production that they could have made by farming that, the money that they could have made by farming that land. Some wind developers also pay neighboring landowners for free access to the wind that blows over their property. They actually need that. You can't line wind turbines up right next to each other. The wind needs an opportunity to recuperate.
Okay, so it's got to be staggered, the placement. Yeah.
Exactly. So they're paying neighboring landowners to make sure that they're not putting up a cell tower or something that's going to impede that flow. It also just helps to spread that revenue out so that more people have a direct financial stake in the wind farm. But beyond those landowner payments, the community also benefits because the wind developers are paying property taxes. Some of those taxes go to the local township or to the county. There's also taxes that are paid to the schools, but this is one of the kind of things that I often tell communities about, that much like mine and your taxes, we redistribute schools on a school tax dollars on a per pupil basis. So most of those revenues get sent to the state and then redistributed in the local community.
It's not pumping right into the local schools. In fact, we'll talk about kind of positive misconceptions a bit later. So as we know then, once an area is identified as a good spot for a wind park, community leaders have to make this decision, opt in, opt out, and people express their views, pro and con. Let's take a listen to some people who are against turbines.
My name is Valerie McCallum. I'm a Lake Township Supervisor in Huron County. I'm opposed to wind turbines for many reasons that would take too much time to to go into. But the bottom line is they're an impractical alternative energy source in Michigan. They're extremely intrusive and costly considering the energy produced. When we need the energy the most on the hottest days, they're not even moving up here.
This is Kevin Martis. We oppose the placement of the wind turbines as proposed by Exelon and Consumers Energy in our township in Blissfield due to the massive size. We already had a existing height limit in our township that people were comfortable with for 40 years of around 40 feet.
My name is Norm Stevens. I'm from Carroll, Michigan, which is in the thumb part of the state. And our township's job is not to conform to the wind energy's business model to make sure that they can install as many turbines as they want. The responsibility the township has is to protect the health, safety, and welfare of residents.
Sarah, how often do you hear sentiments and thoughts like these?
All the time. These are many of the things that come up, and they're some of the right things to come up.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. What else do you hear?
So this in the last clip, there was some mention about health and safety. And so that comes up a lot because these are zoning decisions, and that's what local planning and zoning is supposed to do. Often there are concerns about property values that also come up.
And with that, probably tourism.
Right. So it depends on the yes. kind of community that you're sure. talking about. When if you're in a completely agricultural community, then they're not really thinking about that. Instead, what they're saying is this is a really good opportunity for my farm. Right. And sometimes you'll have farmers speak in support of that. These are the primary concerns, mm-hmm. though. And particularly, I want to get to the size because that has to go with the landscape change. Right. I sit on the Planning Commission in the city of Ann Arbor. And so whenever you have a planning commission meeting, people come to talk about what this is going to mean for their community and how this is going to change their community, right? And so, yeah, you cannot make wind turbines invisible. And modern wind turbines are 500 to 600 feet tall, particularly in flat landscapes. You can see that from quite a ways away.
So as community leaders are weighing these concerns, what I'm going to flip the coin, what are some of the common positive misconceptions that you hear as you go around, that people think it's going to bring in like money to schools? You were kind of alluding to that.
Right. So that's one of the positive misconceptions. Another positive misconception is there's lots of talk and research about all of the jobs that are created from renewable energy, not just wind, mm-hmm. but renewable energy mm-hmm. generally. I'm not going to argue with that. In terms of the local jobs, the jobs that are going to stay in that local community, there are lots of jobs during construction, but not so many jobs that stay wind energy technicians, right? Yeah.
Once these things are spinning, I mean, it's kind of, you're right, they just need to be maintained.
Exactly.
So we've got this tug of war then. We've got concern over, global climate change, a desire for green renewable energy versus these concerns that we've just kind of talked about, size and noise and changing the look of the land forever. How do you help local leaders walk through and address these concerns?
Well, I think one of the things that's important is putting it in perspective about which impacts are overblown. That was a bad pun, and it wasn't intended to be.
But it's a good one.
which benefits are overblown, right? So really trying to help them understand what you can expect. I bring to it the research that's been done in Michigan. You know, I've been in about a third of the communities in Michigan that already have wind farms to try to understand what do people that live there think about them? Mm-hmm. How has that changed their community? Because I think it's really important that you go into any big decision like this with your eyes wide open about either what negatives this could bring or what positives you could be leaving on the table by saying no.
So tell us a sense of for those who have said, all right, build them, here they are, they're in the community. What worked as expected and what was perhaps unexpected for these communities that already have wind farms?
Right. So largely the decision to have wind development is an economic development decision. And so they were expecting the economic benefits to landowners and to, again, the local government, to the local community. My research and a lot of what farmers will say is, yeah, we're seeing that. We're getting our checks in the mail. The neighboring landowners are getting their checks in the mail and they're using it to reinvest in their land. And so they're seeing that. One of the perhaps unexpected things is that on the local government spending side, local officials have told me, like, yeah, we're getting our tax payments in, But what we're using that for is to put towards our long-term retiree obligations, putting it towards long-term debts. And so local communities, the residents in those communities aren't necessarily seeing, like, they don't know how much tax revenue the wind developers are paying. And so that was something that was unexpected.
Okay. What else do you want to have people understand, especially the idea that people who are concerned about the way these things are going to look? What do you hear from people that have had them for a while? Do they get used to them?
Actually, earlier this year, Doug Bissett at Michigan State and I published a paper on exactly this to try to test. Do you learn to live with wind turbines, right? And some people do and some people don't. People who generally have positive attitudes, their attitudes increase over time, you know, improve over time. Those people who, particularly people who thought that the planning process was unfair, they actually grow to feel even more resentful of the wind turbines. One of the things in terms of the impacts that people point out is that they expected that their landscape, their daytime landscape, would change. What people didn't expect is the red lights at night. And unless you've been in the thumb in the evening or driven up 127 in the dark, you don't realize that there is a blinking red light that the FAA requires so airplanes don't hit the turbines. And that you can see from quite a distance.
And you just have, and they're not silent, are they?
They are not silent, yeah. And I think that most people would know that going in, that they're not going to be silent. How much you hear them depends entirely on which way the wind's blowing and kind of what's planted in the field at that time of year. So more of the unexpected complaints, I feel like, have been about, like, we just didn't expect that we would be living in the red light district.
What about communities, when they're considering a wind farm proposal, what else should they look at? Are there alternatives? What about solar?
So solar is an alternative, and there are some communities that, Shiawassee County, for example, turned down a 200-megawatt wind farm but approved a 200-megawatt solar farm. Most of the time, it's not the same developer who does wind and solar, and so it's not like you can just choose which one you want. This was a unique situation where there was a solar developer in the ground at the same time as a wind developer. I think the other thing that's really important here is that these communities, with the exception of Gratiot County, which is an interesting example and we can talk about, are not seeking out wind development themselves. Wind developers are coming here, coming to those communities and saying, we think that your community has the right mix of wind resource and access to transmission, and some landowners who are interested in siting wind turbines on their property. And so what do you think, township government?
But tell me about Gratiot.
So Gratiot County, I'm a planner, right? My PhD is in planning. So maybe to a planner, everything is about planning. But they decided early on that they saw wind development as their opportunity for their community to invest in the agricultural enterprise. So this was the way for farmers to make additional land. So they worked together and included it in their master plan before there was really a proposal on the table and said, these are the rules that we're going to set. We want wind development here. They are not the windiest county in the state, right? But because they proactively planned, they were actually able to entice wind development to come there and have subsequently developed a number of additional projects. But that's the exception to the rule. Most people don't plan ahead.
And so they're reactive.
Exactly. They're reactive. And when you're reactive, you just don't have as much time. You don't have the opportunity to think about, like, what really makes sense. Like, my mantra to everybody is step back and plan. Think about what it is that you want in your community 20 years from now, 25 years from now.
And knowing that Michigan's public utilities, I mean, these aren't going away. They have to satisfy the state's renewable energy portfolio mandate and be at 15% renewable energy by 2021. I mean, so it's coming. And I think I hear you say communities being proactive gets you a lot further ahead than reacting once something's dropped in your laps.
And even beyond the RPS, I mean, that only goes through 2021. Most of the projects that would be developed to meet that are already in the works. Renewable energy, wind energy, solar energy are now the cheapest, or are cheaper, if not the cheapest form of energy. And so this isn't going away. What I've been saying to places across the state is that if you haven't been approached yet for energy development, you probably will in the next 10 years. So it makes sense to think right now about how not just wind, but also solar fit or don't fit with your long-term plans.
Sarah Banas-Mills with the Center for Local, State, and Urban Policy. Close up at the Gerald R. Ford School of Public Policy at the University of Michigan. Sarah, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.